Criminal law is open. The first bill we're going to hear today is House Bill 3330. And Mr. Taylor, if you could give us a rundown. Representative Crupper, if you could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 3330 comes to you from Representative Crupper. It directs the governor to establish an Office of Homeland Security and to appoint a director. Requires the office to employ one or more analysts for the purpose of reviewing and evaluating information relating to terrorist threats. Requires all state agencies to cooperate with the office, establishes the Homeland Defense Fund separate from the general fund, establishes within that fund the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for the National Guard program in order to provide scholarships for qualified members of the Oregon National Guard and spouses and children. It applies to Oregon State universities and community colleges, requires scholarships to be awarded on a competitive basis. Funds the office and the scholarship program through sales of land currently owned by the Oregon Department of Corrections.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. And thanks for allowing my bill to come up first this morning. As you know, I have another important obligation later in the day. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, today you have an opportunity to proactively keep your family safer, and at the same time reward our Oregon National Guard soldiers and their families for their tremendous sacrifice on our behalf in the war on terrorism. House Bill 3330 establishes two trust funds without spending any general fund money. It does this by redirecting money from the sale of the Mill Creek Corrections property east of Salem, which, if you've driven by there lately, you can see there's in the process of being developed. And it takes that money and it establishes these two trust funds. Currently, that money is scheduled to be, a portion of it anyway, you know, the larger portion of it is scheduled to be given to the Oregon Cultural Trust. This money will provide analyst positions, and other positions that are, I believe, in my discussions over the last few months with various members of our Homeland Security organizations and individuals that participate in that, necessary positions that we need to do to keep Oregonians safe, in my opinion. This is not in the governor's budget, however, but I think that you will see that this opportunity that you have before you today will dovetail very nicely in another bill that you will be hearing in regard to the establishment of the Department of Homeland Security for Oregon. It will also, as you know, provide scholarships for the families and servicemen that are serving us and are indeed sacrificing so much for us. Those will be competitive scholarships that will be awarded on a grant basis by the Student Assistance Commission. And the idea here very simply is to take a long-term asset, real property, and to use it for a truly long-term benefit, both in the arena of helping provide proactive security and analysis to keep us safe, and secondarily, to allow opportunities for Oregon soldiers and their families to further their higher education as a way of saying thank you for all that they have done for us. Let me first address to you the issue of being proactive in the arena of homeland security. There is a reason that the other bill that you will hear today is before you. There is a reason that the governor, by executive order, established the Office of Homeland Security. And that is the reason that it is necessary. So if it is necessary to establish it, that means it's necessary to fund it. And this bill provides a mechanism for funding portions of what you will be considering later. Now, why is it important to be proactive? Well, I would offer you two reasons. Why should we wait for Oregon to be attacked from domestic or foreign enemies? I might remind this committee that Oregon is one of two states that have actually incarcerated and convicted its citizens who have threatened and have participated in terrorist activities. I would remind you the story of the Portland Seven, one of which worked for Intel, intelligent people, educated individuals. Another one worked for the mayor's office in the city of Portland. And if you recall that story, you recall that they journeyed to foreign lands to gain access to fight American troops in Afghanistan. One of them was killed in that process. The others are now serving time in the federal penitentiary system. You will also recall that testimony given during that trial indicates that they had considered attacking an Oregon school. That is why it is important that we are proactive. Because what if they had been successful? How would we answer those parents of those dead or wounded children? How would we look within ourselves to say, we did not have, in this nation prior to 9/11, an awareness, a belief that our intelligence apparatus and our security apparatus at the federal and the state and the local level needed to work together to combat terrorism? Well, the 9/11 Commission, I think, laid that out very clearly, that there is a need for our intelligence apparatus to work together. This bill helps create that opportunity here in Oregon. I might also remind you that the story that is front and center in the news today is what? It is the story that tonight, today, the Portland City Council will vote on formally disengaging itself from the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Life is many times about symbolism. The symbolic nature of what is to occur today in the city of Portland in their disengagement has not gone unnoticed. There was a Wall Street Journal editorial roundly criticizing the city of Portland for this decision. And even if the reasons that they are engaging in what they're doing are valid or not, which is very much in dispute, even if they are, what is the message? What is the symbolic nature of what they are achieving today in disengaging? What message does that send to the world? I am concerned about that. You also can send a symbolic message by saying that we're going to redirect monies that were going to go to the arts, and we're going to redirect that to keep Oregonians safe, to help provide the individuals that we need to accomplish that task. I'm going to ask you to think back to September 11th. When you were watching the Twin Towers burning and you watched those towers fall, what were you thinking about? Search your heart and just think for a moment. What were you thinking about? Were you thinking about K-12 funding? Were you thinking about land use decisions? I bet you weren't. I bet you were thinking about, as those towers fell, how many people were dying at that moment and that our country was under attack. And what was most important to you at that moment? Was it the extraneous issues that we debate and talk about here that are important? Yes. But are they as important as keeping our nation and our citizens and our families safe? I do not think they are. If you've been reading in the news lately, there's been stories this week regarding Zarqawi in Iraq. They just missed him the other day. Apparently, they found his laptop computer with extraordinary plans to carry his terrorist activities beyond the boundaries of Iraq and possibly to American shores. Is that possible? Well, what's the other news story that you saw today, or actually 2 days ago? The news story in WorldNet Daily and others you saw on Fox News and other news outlets, that Iran, which is widely considered to be the number one state country that sponsors terrorism throughout the world in terms of using its oil revenues to fund terrorism internationally, and that in fact that they are not only trying to build an atomic weapon, but also now that they are considering using their newly tested Shahab 3 missile to put aboard freighters for the purpose of entering within a few miles of the American coastlines. And apparently Al-Qaeda owns some 80 tramp steamers, as they are called, to put a Shahab 3 missile on one of those steamers to get close to the American coastline and to launch that missile into the air, not with an atomic weapon, but rather a weapon that the United States of America and several other countries already possess. And that is a weapon that creates an electrostatic burst. And one such weapon, it is theorized, released into the American atmosphere, would produce such a damaging burst of electrical activity that it would render much of our infrastructure of utilities and certainly infrastructures that we rely on that are related to computers worthless by damaging them beyond repair immediately. And it may take, some speculate, several months to repair that damage. These are real issues. These are not concocted by right-wing nuts. These are being considered, and many of the people sitting behind me in this room know far more about this than I do. They are real. This bill helps us achieve a proactive stance rather than waiting for us to be attacked in this state. That's the first part of this bill and the first part of the trust fund that is established. And by the way, let's talk about that. Why did we establish trust funds? Because once they are established in perpetuity. And the interest earnings from those trust funds are then used for the purposes that this bill sets out for homeland security here in Oregon and for providing scholarships. They are permanent. They are much more difficult to dismantle because of politics that may occur in the future, either by governors or legislatures. They are permanent. And that's why we're establishing them as trust funds, so that the interest earnings will be used to achieve the purposes that we're trying to achieve in this bill. The second trust fund, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, achieves the same purpose by establishing a trust fund that, as you have heard, creates scholarships on a competitive basis for Oregon National Guard and Reserve soldiers and their families. Now, why do we need to do this? Well, I can tell you from my personal experience of being on the ground in Iraq and talking with Oregon National Guard soldiers in many circumstances, including an impromptu town hall meeting that we had amongst the barrack trailers of Bravo Company, 30 miles north of Baghdad at Taji Base. And the number one concern that I heard time and time again, including this impromptu town hall meeting, was the opportunity to have their educational benefits restored. Because that's why many of these Oregon National Guard members joined the Guard, was not only to help secure our nation, but also to gain those higher education, those college benefits, most of which we had to cut, unfortunately, during the cutbacks of 2002 and in the 2003-05 biennium. This helps restore that. Now, we are going to restore many of those, but only to 90% if we're able to achieve that in the 05-07 budget. This would help take up that slack. As you know, a college education is not an inexpensive activity to engage in this day and age. And this bill establishes that trust fund that helps provide that money to be granted on a competitive basis. We also have read the stories about how many National Guardsmen are choosing not to reenlist. This is a very important issue to them. Oftentimes, when I was in Iraq, I would sit with soldiers, either having breakfast, lunch, or dinner with them, and ask them how many of them were going to reenlist. And typically, I would get 60 to 70% of them say, "I'm done," because of the sacrifice and the tremendous problem this has created in their families, in their lives. And we know that the National Guard nationally is not meeting its recruitment and reenlistment goals, unfortunately. And this is going to be an ongoing problem. So everything that we can do as a state during this legislative session to create opportunities, incentives for our soldiers to remain active in the Guard and the Reserve, I think is appropriate. And it clearly is on their minds. And if they were to walk in here one by one, they would tell you the same. Oregon, by the way, has had, as you know, the highest number of casualties, including deaths, in both Afghanistan and Iraq as a percentage of our troops employed. And yet we have virtually almost the lowest benefits currently of any state that offers benefits to their National Guard and Reserve. And I would ask you, members, to search your hearts on this issue. What I'm asking you is not an easy thing, but I think it is the right thing. What argument can anyone advance that says that the arts are more important than establishing what we're trying to do here today? What argument that anyone can say is more important than keeping our families and our citizens safe by being proactive in the area of homeland security and saying thank you to the families of those who've lost soldiers or been injured or are serving at great personal sacrifice to keep us safe? There's a sense of urgency also, Mr. Chair and members of this committee, because the first block of 145 acres of this property of 500 plus acres will be sold beginning in August of this year. This land will be sold for the neighborhood of $50,000 per acre in the process of being developed. That is what it is worth on the marketplace. 145 acres is roughly $6.5 million. If 145 acres gets sold in the next biennium, the money will be appropriately divided as in the terms of this bill to establish these two trust funds. It then establishes interest earnings, and I might remind you that $6.5 million at 5% interest per year is roughly $325,000 a year. At 10% a year, it's $640,000 or $650,000. I would share with you that the returns of investment that the Treasurer's Office has been able to achieve for the PERS funds alone have been far more than that. In 2004, one of their more conservative portfolios with $7 billion in real estate investment trusts averaged 24%. I think we will be able to do much better. The opportunity is real. It is here. You need to make a decision in what you think is more important. Again, you have the opportunity to convert a long-term asset, real estate, real property, to a long-term benefit for the citizens of this state and for your constituents and your families. And Mr. Chair, I would ask you to consider this. I would ask you to move this bill quickly to the full committee where we can have this discussion there and then the floor and then on to Ways and Means where it will be need to be fully discussed there. And with that, Mr. Chair, I've concluded my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I just a comment or two that especially the way that we're prosecuting the wars in the Middle East, we don't see any casualties from Harvard. We don't see any casualties from Yale. It's traditionally the working families or the people who supply the sons and daughters to go off to war. And this time it's even more so that way in the people who, like you said, are trying to work towards college, trying to better themselves, suddenly find themselves called to active duty, and they're doing an excellent job, and they are certainly not being paid, is not the right word. We're not compensating like we should. And if we can have an opportunity to afford them educations, which will help them not only lift themselves but lift Oregon, I think it's a very good expenditure of any of these funds. I really appreciate you bringing this forward.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are preparing a Dash 1 amendment that will make some small changes in the bill. One of them is in my discussions with Bev Stilwell, who is here in the back of the room as the Director of the Office of Homeland Security. They felt that they needed positions for not only an intelligence analyst, but also support personnel for secure communications equipment and geographic intelligence systems that are so important for us being able to integrate our emergency response organizations at the local level. I sit on a fire board of a small rural fire department that covers a major state highway on an east-west route. That's Highway 22 that runs from Salem to Central Oregon. I was a volunteer fire captain for 12 years. And have went through a fair amount of hazardous materials training and understand very much the importance of what we're trying to achieve here today. Having our ability to communicate with the state police, with the Oregon National Guard, Office of Emergency Management Office of Homeland Security, hopefully the Department of Homeland Security soon, and the FBI and all of our other intelligence apparatuses and response apparatus have the ability to do that, which we don't have very well today, and you know that. Having the ability to do that and funding these positions is important. Yes, this is not in the governor's budget, but I'm offering you an opportunity to create these. And you can ask the veracity of my argument. You can ask the people behind me, even though they, again, will have to tell you this is not in the governor's budget. They will tell you also that there are needs and that this bill can potentially meet those needs.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for our
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3330. Open a hearing on House Bill 2101. And like Chief Johnson, I know you have to be heading down the road, so we'll get you up there, and Craig Campbell. And Ms. Stillwell, see. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Johnson. I'm the fire chief for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. And by way of introduction, which will provide a backdrop for my testimony today, I am also the chair of Oregon's Statewide Interoperability Executive Council, which is charged with the responsibility of creating essentially what you have in your cell phones today as a roaming service. That doesn't work that way in public safety radios. The area that your radio is assigned to with a system, you have to be basically on that system, or there have to be some way to plug into other systems, and the SIEC is charged with that responsibility. In addition to that, I am the president of the Western Fire Chiefs Association, which serves the 10 western states, and I hope my comments will reflect my observations about what's working and not working in the 10 western states as it relates to this bill today. I have worked in Oregon in the public safety community as a firefighter and now a fire chief for 27 years. And this bill does more to create an integrated emergency response system and approach for Oregon than anything I've seen in that 27 years. There has often been well-intentioned but nonetheless statutory and functional siloing that occurs between the police, the fire, the emergency management personnel, and our communication system as it exists today is just a symptom of that siloing that's gone on for years. This bill does so much to bring those people under one plan, one system. Governor's Executive Order 0405, which created the Department of Homeland Security under Beverly Stilwell's direction today, has already caused tremendous achievements in the area of interoperability, in the area of integrating the local responders and the military responders and the police responders. And it really has prepared us, I believe, for any potential terrorist threat or, it's often forgotten in these day and times, but in natural disasters as well. The Office of the State Fire Marshal would also fall under this particular department. And the State Fire Marshal's Office is the department that provides structural fire protection during conflagrations. And if I'm looking at the weather patterns for this year, I'm quite concerned that we're going to have a record year. Rains this late often mean tall fuels. And this is an essential function. And what's often missed in these conflagrations, unless you're front line, is it isn't just the firefighters there, but it is the firefighters, it's the police, it's often the National Guard and many other local resources. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Oregon is unique in our designed approach for homeland security. And I think it's critical that we be unique. I think there's sheer brilliance in bringing together the police, military, and fire components under one umbrella, because when bad things happen in Oregon, whether brought on by foreign interests or whether they're brought on by natural disasters, these are the three entities that need to come together and work to serve the citizens of Oregon. It's about an integrated response. It's not just about terrorism. And the value of coordination in terms of saving taxpayers' dollars, taking four independent radio systems that the state owns today and designing a single future system that is a system of systems gives you so much opportunity to save state money, I think it would be a shame to pass it up. I think it is reflective of the future that this bill will bring to Oregon, that the statewide interoperability executive council is made up of as many local governments as state agencies, all of which own systems and are anxious to tie them together in a way that provides access and affords long-term cost avoidance and cost savings. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for the progress that's been made in Oregon in these last couple years, and I would encourage you to continue to strive to tie local and state and federal resources together, because at the responder level, we're ready to do it. We need the tools, if I may, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we need the tools that will enable us to plan and coordinate. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll defer to my colleagues and avail myself to any questions you may have.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions? I know Chief Johnson needs the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Johnson, when you're referring to the State Interoperability Executive Council, you're referring to something that's in the proposed amendment, the rough draft amendment, am I correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thanks.
Anything further? Chief, if you need to leave, please feel free. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate your attention.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm the governor's senior policy advisor, and I also have the privilege of being Oregon's Homeland Security advisor. I wanted to begin by talking to you a little bit about the underlying need for the new department, which is, in fact, twofold. One, of course, is dealing with the terrorism threat. And there's always the threat when you live in Oregon that you will either consider that Oregon is not what would be considered a critical enough state for terrorism to find a home here or act here. But unfortunately, we have, as our Representative Trump mentioned earlier, have a history where we have, in fact, had active terrorism here in the state of Oregon and continue to do so. Prior to September 11, 2001, and subsequent to that, it has become a critical responsibility of the state to make sure that we are prepared to respond, prevent, and prepare for the potentiality of a terrorist event. In addition to that, and one of the other elements that we're going to be talking about today in creating a Department of Homeland Security is the need to focus also on the all-hazards approach, because there is not a tremendous amount of difference in the way first responders must respond to a terrorist event versus a natural or man-made disaster. Now, there are going to be amendments that are going to be provided to you and will be covered more fully by Mr. Keith Cutler of the Department of Justice and Beverly Stilwell, the Director of our Office of Homeland Security, and they will take you through those amendments. My comments today are going to be more general, but do touch on the general ideas that are covered in those amendments. When we looked at creating a department, the governor wanted to make sure that we were cognizant of the fact that we did, in fact, have limited resources, and we did not want to create a new monster. There's certainly the potentiality, if you look across state spectrum, all the things that we need to have playing together to effectively create a Homeland Security Department, but it's not necessary for us to create all of those elements under the same department. So what we did is we have created what is essentially needed. It's satisfied Oregon's key Department on Homeland Security executive order and essentially carries those things over and puts them in statute. The bottom line is we knew we needed to figure out a way to keep the public safe. And the only way we could do that is by combining those critical elements that needed to be under one roof. That makes Oregon different from every other state in the approach for Homeland Security. A number of states use a military model, many of them use a state police model, and many of them use an Oregon emergency management, an emergency management model. Oregon combines all of them. We're the only state Homeland Security entity to combine military, law enforcement, fire, and civilian emergency response into one place. Now, it's critical for us to make sure that all of those are in one place. You can't leave any of them out, and let me explain a little bit about the role of the military first. They provide manpower, critical assets, and training in crisis response. The National Guard is exceptionally well-skilled in responding to emergencies at the state level, especially mass emergencies that require an awful lot of assets to be provided very quickly. In addition, they carry key connections with our federal military partners. Now, federally, there's kind of a bit of a siloing going on that we have yet to resolve in Homeland Security. Part of it is the civilian side, which is located in the form of the Federal Department of Homeland Security. And the other one, of course, is the Department of Defense and the military response should a Homeland Security event ever occur in the country. What we wanted to do is create a department that was capable of bringing together the key players so that we could prepare for, prevent, respond if necessary, and then recover from any event that could arise under an all-hazards approach, whether that was a terrorist event or a man-made or natural disaster. In addition to that, we needed to create a structure that allowed us to both integrate with our federal partners because they have put a tremendous amount of responsibilities on the state through a series of presidential Homeland Security orders that, quite frankly, take up a little bit more than 50% of the Office of Homeland Security's time in making sure that we are responding to those directives which are designed to better able us to cooperate and coordinate at the local level and to access federal needs. In addition, we have to be flexible enough and small enough that our local partners are capable of knowing if there's an emergency and they need support, and that's primarily what the state's role is, they know who to go to very quickly and they know that they don't have to go through a lot of layers of government to get that response. The Department of Homeland Security will be responsible for assisting in creating protection for the public and the places they frequent, such as schools, malls, places of worship, and tourist locations. In addition, we have to be able to protect critical infrastructure, including our ports, our food supply, our transportation infrastructure, our power generation and distribution facilities, our telecommunication systems, our major business enterprises, and our information technology infrastructure. That means that we have to have plans in place that will go beyond what the essential four elements of the new Department of Homeland Security will be. There are two ways you could do that. You could try and bring all of those under one umbrella, which would create a huge bureaucratic nightmare, quite frankly, in one agency. Or you can give the Department of Homeland Security the ability to coordinate and facilitate with other state agencies what those agencies are already responsible for doing. And what I'd like to do is very briefly go through a short list of what those other agencies are and what their responsibilities are. The Department of Administrative Services has responsibility for business continuity planning, which essentially means if something happens to disrupt state government, they have a plan for restoring those services in an order of preference. They also are responsible for protecting Oregon's information technology. The Department of Human Services has responsibility for responding to biohazard, disease control, and health response in the case of those emergencies. The Department of Transportation has the responsibility for protecting our transportation infrastructure, regulating the shipping of hazardous materials, and provision for routes of evacuation should that become necessary. The Department of Justice, whose criminal division is a critical partner with the Oregon Homeland Security Watch Center, provides critical analysis of potential terrorist activity to make sure that when and if we must act against those who are engaged in such activity, that we do so without errors, and that we are making sure that we are watching our constitutional protections as we do so, so that we can appropriately bring those who deserve so to justice. The Department of Agriculture has the responsibility of protecting Oregon's food supply and protecting the integrity of Oregon's agricultural exports and protecting us from the introduction and spread of food-based diseases. The Department of Environmental Quality is responsible for mediating toxic events, monitoring, protecting Oregon's water sources from contamination. And those elements that are part of the Department of Homeland Security in whole or part, the Oregon Fire Marshal has responsibility for hazmat teams, hazardous materials tracking, and linking with local fire first responders to make sure we have a clear and open route of communication with them in the event of an emergency. Also, Oregon Emergency Management, which has a tremendous responsibility for facilitating with our local first responders to make sure that there are plans in place to respond to any potential disaster, whether terrorist-related or man-made. And then, of course, we also have two partners which we have linked with the Department of Homeland Security under the bill, Oregon State Police, whose responsibility it is to help with the early identification of criminal activity that has a terrorist nexus, whether foreign or domestic, has specialized units to respond to such threats, such as the bomb squad, urban search and rescue, and also serves as a critical conduit with our law enforcement partners, including participation on the Joint Terrorism Task Force and our Homeland Security Watch Center. I should point out here that there are really two types of critical information or secure information that pass through when dealing with Homeland Security. What you are more likely to hear about are those that are used in the intelligence circles, which are those that have for official use only designations or that require a secret or top secret clearance. There's a completely separate bit of information that is also intelligence that is law enforcement sensitive. You can't cross those streams without having both people in the room. Law enforcement cannot always release law enforcement sensitive data just by virtue of me or somebody else having a secret or top secret clearance. You have to have law enforcement present with you to convey that information, which is why we wanted to make sure both were present and a part of the Department of Homeland Security. Again, the National Guard, as I mentioned, provides those critical links with our federal partners in the Department of Defense. They provide force assistance and provide specialized units such as the Weapons of Mass Destruction Civil Response Team, which in the event of a chemical, biological, or radiological event can identify those events to make sure that we have critical information to guide us for a safe and swift response to that emergency. So as you see, almost every element of state government has a role to play. But if you try to combine all those in one place, you would quickly have a very convoluted and difficult to manage agency. So we wanted to keep it streamlined and with low cost. Is there a cost to this? Yes. There is a general fund budget impact. And I could make some snide comment about how the cost for not doing this would be X amount, but I think this committee has a clear understanding of the need for moving forward with a proposal like this without talking about the need for cost. Essentially, we've tried to keep it as small as possible, and the impact of the general fund will be something less than $1 million. That's because we have taken existing elements and combined them to be more efficient. We're cognizant that the state is strapped for cash, but we wouldn't prioritize that money for this purpose if we didn't think this was a critical next step. You're now going to hear from the certified smart people, the director of the Office of Homeland Security, Beverly Stilwell is with us, as are a number of those people who head up the divisions within the Office of Homeland Security who are also able to provide you background information. And so with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Is the mayor of Portland able to opt out of this program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, the idea with the Department of Homeland Security is not for a sign-up participation, but for us to have a constant outreach and communication with our local partners. And if we find resistance with that local entity, we will continue to make every effort to make sure that we keep the lines of communication open until we find a way to successfully do it. It's just too important for us to let that kind of communication drop, whatever the response may be. And that goes with our communication to the federal level as well. We'll continue to work through any barriers that we may find there. I hope that was a politically enough ambiguous answer to.
Would you appreciate an amendment requiring them to take part? We can arrange that. I'm not very
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, it's always good to be in front of a committee knowing what kind of questions you may get. What we find is, and the entire structure here is really where you can reach your end result by facilitating coordination voluntarily, you're always ultimately going to get a better response, I think. So as much as I would appreciate that offer, I think it will really be incumbent upon us to make sure that we just work through open and agreeable means to make sure that we make those connections work. But thank you for the offer.
You can use diplomacy, which is the art of letting the other person have your way.
Representative Person.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Campbell, there's one aspect of the reorganization that caught my attention here. It's referenced in the staff measure summary, and I see it in what I guess is a redraft of the bill in Section 16.3, and that is that included in the new department would be the division that administers the federal grant programs aimed at reducing drug use and violent crime and improving the effectiveness of the criminal justice system. And that seems like that's maybe reaching a little further afield beyond what would seem to be within the scope of terrorism and natural disaster response.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that's actually a very good point. When we moved elements out of, in particular, the Department of State Police, we took them whole cloth, instead of breaking them up. Most of them had a very good fit, State Fire Marshal, Office of Public Safety and Security, and Oregon Emergency Management. However, the Criminal Justice Services Division, which manages the Homeland Security grants, also manages the burn grant and some other grants. Because we had a body of expertise there, which we needed to keep in one place, we ended up carrying with them some of their other funding responsibilities. And what we've done to try and facilitate our way through that is make sure that they have good coordination with entities such as the Criminal Justice Commission, the Commission on Children and Families, etc. Although those responsibilities will still be under the Department of Homeland Security, they really will not have much of an emergency response or a Homeland Security core mission. But most of what they do, which is administering the Homeland Security grants, will be a key component there. We may at some point in time figure out a way to transfer those other elements out, but it's just not a large enough entity to be able to do that efficiently.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee, good morning. My name is Beverly Stillwell, and I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Homeland Security. I provided some written testimony and also a wire diagram of the Office of Homeland Security as it currently exists. And I think that Craig Campbell has covered very well the different elements that are contained in it. What I have here for you is a visual so that you can see the reporting structure and how it's laid out. It's a total of 122 full-time equivalent employees that would be moved from the Oregon State Police to the Office of Homeland Security. And again, as Mr. Campbell mentioned, addition of a few staff, 5 FTE total, to do the administrative function for the department that the Department of State Police currently performs. That would include human resources, personnel, and payroll. So it is just a combining of some elements into the single department, very streamlined. We see our role really is one of coordination and outreach, and we've had a tremendous success based upon a lot of the requirements that the federal government is putting down on the Homeland Security dollars, in being able to leverage people to begin working together, planning together, arranging for mutual aid agreements, and responding together. So it's been a tremendous impact of the federal dollars into the state, approximately $117 million over the course of the last 5 years has been reached to our state borders and then in turn subgranted out to local jurisdictions. So the impact of Homeland Security is real. I think one thing that we need to make sure and always do is keep our focus on all hazards. As Chief Johnson mentioned, we do have the potential of fire season. We have a lot of potentials that are on the horizon that our first responders have to respond to, that it's not just a terrorist attack. So the more that we can be prepared and utilize the funds and be able to transfer those skills into the various events that might happen in our communities, the better prepared that we are as a group. That pretty much concludes my testimony. I think, again, that Craig has covered it quite well. As Chief Johnson and Representative Krupp, in setting the stage for domestic preparedness, terrorism, and the need for the creation of this department.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Keith Cutler from the Department of Justice. And if I may, I'll give you a brief overview of the draft amendments that have been handed out today and how they differ from the bill as drafted. I'm, of course, willing to go into it in excruciating detail, but presume that you don't want to do that quite yet. The bill as drafted, the main concept was actually to convert the Office of Emergency Management into the Department of Homeland Security. And I think you've already heard discussion this morning about the structure that's desired, which is to have the department being the overarching department with other structures left intact. One of the reasons for leaving the other structures intact is that there's less disruption, less confusion among people who deal, for example, with the Office of Emergency Management now in its current guise. If it were to change names, even the mere change of a name would impose a lot of costs in terms of changing stationery, changing email addresses, and how people communicate with them. So by doing it this way, not only is the structure more efficient for the government, but it avoids some costs that might otherwise have been imposed. Another significant change, and this was touched on by Mr. Taylor in his question to Chief Johnson earlier, the State Interoperability Executive Council was not included in the original draft, and yet that is a key part of this department, and that is included in the redraft. Now, the redraft at this point is a work in process. We have a little bit of tweaking to do. We expect to have that done within the next couple of days, and at that point, we'll be ready with your permission to submit that to Legislative Council, and we'd be available to work with them as as this develops. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to field them.
Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Cutler, and Mr. Campbell, we had another bill before us, House Bill 3330, which also creates a Homeland Security office. My assumption is that if both bills were to move forward, we'd have to make them compatible. Is that correct? Because even though they intend the same outcome, they do it in different manners.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, yes, that's correct. You need to make sure that they did the same thing. There's no real point in having two state laws that don't coordinate well. We have to create an Office of Homeland Security, which we already have. And what we really want to do is have one entity that's responsible for Homeland Security. So, yes, if both bills move forward, you would need to make sure that those were consistent.
Further questions, Mr. Chairman of the committee. Scott, I noticed in the original bill, the draft does away with the Office of Emergency Management, and I'm quickly reading the other one, and I see the functions and duties are transferred, but I don't see any provision that does that abolishes it. Maybe I just haven't got to it yet. But
sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the concept is that the Office of Emergency Management is not to be abolished. It's to remain as it is. But as it is in present law, it's part of the Department of State Police.
Okay.
The change would be to make it part of the Office of Homeland Security, the Oregon Homeland Security Department. Similarly, the Office of State Fire Marshal, which is now part of the State Police, would move to the new department.
Mr. Chairman, so they're keeping the same functions, you're just moving them lock, stock, and barrel, as opposed just to moving the functions?
Of those individual offices, if, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next signed up, Mr. Castagna and Mr. Hamilton.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Robert J. Castagna, General Counsel and Executive Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. The Oregon Catholic Conference is the public policy voice of the Catholic Bishops of Oregon, serving Oregon's Catholic population of more than 425,000 Oregonians in support of the common good for all Oregonians. We're here today, Mr. Chair, to suggest an amendment to House Bill 2101. In the original printed version of the bill, as well as in the amendments that were on the handout table, the Section 2 language of the bill says that the department shall be responsible for coordinating and facilitating private sector and governmental efforts to prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from emergencies. We are very appreciative, as the Oregon Catholic Conference, of the efforts of first responders in our daily life, police, fire, emergency medical technicians, ambulance drivers, attendants, hospital personnel. We do want to suggest for the amendment the Dash 1 amendments, which would ensure religious liberties and constitutional rights of religious organizations, by suggesting that during any temporary taking ordered by the department because of an emergency, an act that is contrary to the religious beliefs or tenets of a religious group or entity may not be performed by a public body or by a person on property owned, leased, or operated by a religious group or entity. We would hope that in the response to any potential tragic event, God forbid there is one, that the hospitality and the participation of religious organizations in helping the community to respond to such an event would be cognizant of and respectful of the religious beliefs and tenets of that religious organization, which would be providing space to the public.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from anybody?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Castagna, I need an example. What might happen on a religious property that would be contrary to the religious beliefs that of the property owner that you're concerned about?
Well, let's say, for example, a community center is being used as a place of refuge for people who have been displaced for their homes as a result of a tragic event, and that some of these people are injured and that the period of time goes on for weeks and weeks. From our perspective, unfortunately, physician-assisted suicide is legal in the state of Oregon. We would not like to see physician-assisted suicide occur on church property in violation of our religious beliefs.
Okay. Just as an initial reaction, assisted suicide is for terminally ill patients. It's a little hard to combine that example with the fact pattern you're describing, as far as I know. But
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, if there are injured persons as a result of a, again, God forbid, a terrorist attack, be it chemical, biological, or nuclear in nature, one could certainly anticipate there would be injured people who would be brought to a shelter or a refuge center.
Mr. Representative, if it was long-term, if they're in there for months, there might be somebody who would fall into that category, who would dying of natural causes or whatever, but if we were using the...
Right. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's helpful.
I think that's... Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Hamilton.
Yes. My name is Greg Hamilton, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm president of the Northwest Religious Liberty Association and public affairs and religious liberty director for the Seventh-day Adventist Church in the Northwest, representing 35,000 church members, two hospitals, 35 elementary schools, and three secondary schools. We share the concerns of the Oregon Catholic Conference, and we are backing this amendment and seconding this amendment and urge this upon you. And we, too, seek to maintain church autonomy at all times under such circumstances, under state emergency actions or federal or whatever, but here clearly state. So we back this amendment.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I talked to Mr. Castagna about this yesterday a little bit, and if I could just direct your attention to page 7 under section 26, and if I may read it, Oregon Emergency Management Plan means the state agency preparedness operations and management plan. Carmel says the Office of Emergency Management is responsible for coordinating emergency planning with government agencies and private organizations, preparing the plan for the governor's signature and maintaining and updating the plan as necessary. My sense is that the committee is planning to go this way in the amendment. There may be a need to look at the current law and to make it at least compatible. What I see is a potential two different statutes talking two different ways.
Okay. Any further questions? Mr. Tudor, how would we proceed with that then?
I can talk to the Legislative Council's office, Mr. Chairman of this committee.
So we shouldn't. We're not going to have a work session today, so we shouldn't move the amendments today.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I take it we will not be able to go to. I think it's just for hearing.
Yeah, it is just for hearing.
So whatever sense of the committee is on amendments, I can probably put them together.
Okay, thank you.
As a unit or individually, however you would prefer, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Okay. Any further discussion? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I get a motion. Oh no, we're just. See, we want to move the amendments in. You'd like to move the amendments in?
These are amendments are prepared by DOJ, but they're not LC blasts.
Okay.
So
okay.
Am I right about that? The amendments have been drafted by DOJ, but they haven't gone to the Legislative Council, so they're not ready to be.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, these are rough draft amendments from the Department of DOJ. They're not from Legislative Council's office. In the scheme of things, they're considered conceptual, even though they're fairly well done.
Okay. Now, I'll close the public hearing. Is anybody else here to testify on 2101? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2101, and we'll work on that. That part makes sense. I mean, I could see where they're going to have that, but I don't know what else that might include.
Well, even then, it seems to be interesting. Maybe it's between the people, right? What such a suicide is, and how, what's the likelihood that some church facility is going to be taken over for long enough that a person diagnosed of a terminal illness?
Yeah, not. Well, of course, it could be. If you get a good blastering age. We're going to recess for just a few minutes. We're waiting for some witness. And come up four people in the first panel. Bruce Anderson, Charles Roy, French, also for Chuck French. I'm sorry. Bad handwriting there. Should have been a doctor. Carla Peluso and Tim Kirkman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. Bruce Anderson with the House Speaker's Office here to testify in support of House Bill 2313 and the amendments before you. Wanted to basically just hit on a couple of points with you, give you a little background, and then turn it over to the experts, if you will. Basically, kind of how this bill came about last fall. And I think we had some members of the Interim Joint Judiciary Committee and the Emergency Board attend a tour that the Speaker Minnis conducted in Northeast Portland, or put together in Northeast Portland and East Multnomah County. And Chief Peluso from Gresham and her staff, along with others from Troutdale, and chiefs from Troutdale and Fairview and Portland Police Bureau helped out in conducting the tour for us. And it was basically mainly focused on gang enforcement issues. Gang violence has been a rising and growing problem in East Multnomah County for some time. It's greatly concerned House Speaker Minnis. And we heard several things from the police officers on the ground when we conducted the tour, one of whom pointed out the challenges that the police are facing with identifying gang members. People they know are gang members. But my understanding is due to some restrictions in law and case law and so forth that they've really been constricted from doing their jobs in protecting our streets and neighborhoods from crime. So establishing some things in law to help police officers in the field, on the street, is really what we're attempting to do in House Bill 2313. I think the language that you have before you lays out some good parameters for our police officers and our prosecutors in getting these people where they belong after they've committed some crimes. I don't want to go into the detail on that, but I think section one in the bill where we're talking about defining what a gang is, what a gang member is, I think those are some good parameters. And we believe that this bill will give law enforcement and the prosecutors the tools that they need to bring these folks to justice and deal with this terrible crime, like I said, which is really, we've seen escalating in East Multnomah County to a great degree. And also, I would just point out that was another reason why the House Speaker pushed for $2 million at the January E-Board meeting. Like I said, what we can do here at the legislature, I think, is what the House Speaker would like to do, giving tools to police officers and the district attorneys to get these guys off the street is, I think, what we're about here. And I think the bottom line on the issue is this, that we, while we empathize with the challenges that some of our troubled youth have in this state, there's a big reason why they're joining these gangs. We understand that, but we cannot overlook the need to protect our cities and communities. And on that point, I would just close and turn it over to the others. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Anderson? Thank you. Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the subcommittee. My name is Chuck French. I'm a deputy district attorney in Portland for Multnomah County. I have worked in the office for almost 24 years, and I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2313. I appreciate the opportunity of being allowed to come here and talk to you about that. Specifically, I think the reason I'm here is because I have some basic understanding of the problem. From 1990 to 1995, I was a member of our gang prosecution unit. Those were, I'm sure you'll recall, Chair Barker, probably the bad old days of gang activity in Portland. We developed a number of strategies to work with prosecuting gang, and strategies that turned out ultimately to be somewhat successful, but very, very cost
ineffective and very, very cumbersome. We ended up prosecuting four of the five major gangs in Portland by using racketeering prosecutions, which turned out to be extremely lengthy, turned out to be a drain on police resources, and really not effectively fit the situation. Many of the or some of the counts in those convictions were reversed. We had to come back to the legislature and tinker with that statute a little bit. The legislature did oblige us and change the statute, but we found that that particular method of prosecution really is not ideally geared to targeting that type of criminal activity. Ultimately, I think we managed to reduce some of the gang activity in Northeast Portland, and the result of that, I think, was that we did not move ahead in innovative approaches here in the state of Oregon, as they have in California. They've continued to update their gang gang enforcement laws there, and we really haven't done that in this state. The result of that has been we've seen a reemergence of gang problems, a little bit different, I think. I think Chief Peluso will testify a little bit about that problem in East County that we have there, but we are seeing a reemergence of the same type of problems we had to deal with 10 years ago. What we are suggesting here and what this bill does is in many ways align some of our statutes with the concepts that they have produced in California to deal with the problem. In short, attempting to penalize by adding some period of time to a prison sentence or someone who's convicted for an activity which was the result of or intended to enhance gang by a gang member who is involved in gang activity, essentially. This is a concept I think we need as a tool. It's a concept that really is not that far away from some of the sentencing guidelines enhancements, so it's not really a great leap or departure from where we have been in other sentencing contexts here. It just needs to be carefully spelled out, and I think this bill does that. I know that there have been some objections to some of the language in earlier drafts of this bill that certainly probably should be addressed just to make the bill a little bit more streamlined. So to that effect, as I read the OCDLA's written testimony here, there are some things that I would agree with there. But the concept, I think, is one which I think we need to move forward with in the state of Oregon unless we're going to allow or be prepared to allow the gang problem to get out of hand as it was in the early 1990s. That's all I have to say. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, and I'll turn it over to Chief Peluso.
Are there any questions? Okay, thank you. Chief?
Good morning. My name is Carla Peluso. I am the chief of the Gresham Police Department. I've been employed by the Gresham Police Department for a little over 26 years, and I've served in capacity as chief for the last 2.5. In June of 2004, the Gresham Police Department, in conjunction with the Public Safety Coordinating Council of Multnomah County, published a report on Healthy Communities, a Youth Gang Prevention Strategy specific for Gresham and East Multnomah County. In our introduction, we noted that gang violence in East Multnomah County has steadily increased since 2000. The Gresham Police Department's highest priority has been keeping gang violence in check. They commit a high level of police resources to gang enforcement and coordinate with law enforcement and community partners, yet have not been able to reduce the level of violence even during winter months that usually bring decreased activity. We also made reference to the demographics of our community, which is ever-changing. Gang violence has been an issue in East County since, which we identified as east of 162nd, and the Gresham area for about 15 years, but over recent years has been growing. Police now estimate about 1,000 youth and younger adults are involved, including about 400 members, 400 involved on the fringes, and an additional 200 gang-affected youth, such as siblings. The Rockwood neighborhood has been particularly affected by gang issues due to the affordable rents, proximity to the MAX line, and change in the area demographics. The resulting violence has created a threat for families in the area, especially those with children at risk for being attracted to gangs. Monday, I testified at the City of Gresham's budget hearing that among the highest priorities for the Gresham Police Department are gangs and the ever-increasing number of gang members, as well as a trend of more aggressive behavior being displayed by gang members, including assaults against other members, citizens and authority figures, vandalism, weapons-related crimes, and drug-related crimes. It is with that background I am pleased to come in support of House Bill 2313. Included in that bill is a clear definition of a criminal street gang, criminal street gang member, and gang-related incidents. I believe this will add a strong deterrent by sending a strong and consistent message throughout the state of what the standards are in the state of Oregon that will not be not only the standards that establish, but the standards that will not be tolerated in issues related to gang activity. This adds a consistent message for both law enforcement and for those who may make choices to become involved in gang activity. Truly, there is an intelligence network among gangs throughout our state, throughout the Northwest. This message will spread and will allow us an opportunity to maybe stop a problem before it starts. It will also strengthen the admissibility of gang-related evidence into the prosecution piece, truly an area which will help us break the cycle. We also believe that adjoining states have strong laws which have allowed displacement, for want of a better word, of gang members to come to the state of Oregon to settle in areas where it is not clearly defined or identified and cause us a considerable amount of grief. So again, the clear definition assists those in law enforcement in both intelligence gathering and intelligence sharing and information sharing with all of those that are involved in the battle against gangs. It also sends a strong message to those who would choose a lifestyle of gang-related activities that those activities will not be tolerated. I thank you for your time and attention. I've asked Lieutenant Gerkman of our department, who established and has enhanced our gang enforcement efforts, to join me in case there are questions.
Thank you. Questions?
You were referring to California's sentence enhancement. You're saying it is pushing people out of those areas and into Oregon. Have you looked at any statistics to see if after they enacted these enhancements, if they really, I'm just wondering what the results were, how effective were they?
You know, Representative Thatcher, I have to be honest, I'm speaking more anecdotally than anything else. It's off those instincts and where we see people who are landing in our communities are coming from California. We know that, but I can't put firm numbers to that.
Mr. Chair, one thing I would point out that I think is worth bringing up, what was just, I think, absolutely terrific about the tour that Chief Peluso and her staff conducted, and especially their staff, they really got into the nitty-gritty details of because we talk about gangs, I think, somewhat peripherally, but until you get in to those neighborhoods and areas and see what is being talked about, what the communities and what law enforcement is facing up there with the graffiti, with just some of the identifying marks or you know, symbols or what have you.
Thanks.
Yes. It's really interesting, and it's a dynamic that I certainly hadn't ever been engaged with before. And I don't know if the chief might want to talk about that in terms of the gangs that we have up here in the area, because I think we've seen, it's been clear the migration that we've seen and the influence that they've had.
Well, there's clearly a posturing, whether it's shown in tagging, whether it's shown in street corner gatherings, where it's an intimidating sense. Lieutenant Gerkman can better address the actual gang members, the gangs that we are seeing in our area. Another dynamic we're seeing are Gresham-grown gangs, where people have come into our community and basically given the tools to those to establish gangs. You know, gang members, I hesitate to classify as thugs. There's a very strong knowledge base and intelligence to form these networks. And what we're working towards is the network, that same intelligence level of information gathering to combat those underlying developmental stages. And again, Lieutenant, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Good morning.
I can add to that that it's
can
not
you just
only
identify yourself for the record,
I'm sorry. I'm Tim Gerkman. I'm a lieutenant with the Gresham Police Department. I've been employed for about 20 years in law enforcement. I've had an opportunity to work at an enforcement level with gangs to a limited degree over a short period of time in helping establish our gang unit. We do find that gang members are involved in the tagging, the identifying. To a degree, there's still the similar clothing, tattoos. But sometimes it's just in conduct or the way they represent themselves on the streets. Sometimes it's not a glaring criminal activity that they're involved in. But sometimes it's the intimidation, it's the gathering on a corner, for lack of a better word, terrorizing a neighborhood just by their presence and their intimidating conduct.
I just throw in one other thing that I found incredibly fascinating was one of the things as we're driving along, they're pointing out convenience stores and so forth and how those are gathering points for these folks, the ones that stay open late at night or 24 hours a day, and how that's a convenient gathering point. Or how, as the chief pointed out, the proximity to the MAX line, for example, enables folks to be able to jump on and be able to have a great transition to the city of Portland or what have you, or from city of Portland to Gresham or elsewhere in East Multnomah County. It just was a real eye-opening experience to really get into some of these very incredible details I certainly never would have gotten into. So
we're also finding, too, that in addition to some of those person-on-person violent crimes, that we're also seeing gang members involved more and more in property-related crimes. Stealing vehicles, breaking into vehicles, and drug dealing. So we're seeing more and more of that.
And one other thing I might point out, if Chief Nelson from Troutdale were here, he could talk to you about the problems that they have at Reynolds High School. They've got gang problems getting into and influencing at the high school now.
I'd like to ask Mr. French, this is more than just listing people as being gangsters. How will this help in the prosecution of the crimes?
Well, I think any time that you have the Chair Barker and members of the subcommittee, any time that you have the ability to enhance a sentence on the type of felony crimes we're talking about here, it increases the ability of the state to target this type of activity. And one of the points that I wanted to make here, that I think it's very important for everyone to understand, unless you actually been involved in it and seen the activity and seen the neighborhoods as they are affected, that gang crimes may individually be appear relatively minor, hand-to-hand drug dealing, possession of a weapon, sometimes a physical assault, sometimes a shooting. Individually, these may be serious, they may not be serious, but taken as a whole, the sum of gang activity is far greater than just the individual parts, because what it effectively does is it reduces the control that people feel in their own, legitimate, good citizens feel, the control they have over their neighborhood is lost. And as I think you're hearing here, these gang members do not do this in the dark. They do it out in the open where everyone can see them for a particular reason, and that reason is that they wish to establish control over their neighborhood, their particular turf. And the corollary to that is when they do establish control over that, when they are successful in that, your good citizens lose control over their neighborhood. And so that's why I think we need a tool, not a cumbersome tool like a racketeering statute, but a fairly effective tool like this, so we can target individuals who are involved in that type of activity. That's why some type of statute like this is very, very effective in prosecuting gang members, simply for one, providing a message to all other gang members, and then getting the real bad actors off the street and into jail or prison.
And I'd like to ask you one further thing. I got a letter from Chief Foxworth, who was a poster, and in reading the letter, I think he doesn't understand what the law is intended. And he feels, or his letter indicated that he felt there would be, this could lend to disparate treatment of blacks and Latinos and Asians, that just the fact that somebody, he said, like when he was a kid growing up and he went to, I think it's now King's School, but it was a different name in those days, that he associated that some of the kids he went to school with were bad actors, and therefore he felt like this would have labeled him, affected him, and would have caused him problems. Can you address that question?
Sure, I'd be happy to, Chair Barker. I worked very closely with Chief Foxworth. He was a lieutenant at the time in the gang enforcement team in the early 1990s when we instituted the racketeering prosecutions I've spoken about. I think the Portland Police Bureau in the late 1980s and the early 1990s probably did themselves a disservice by over classifying gang members. And I can understand his concern in that ultimately there was a consent decree signed which eliminated what they were doing, which was classifying people on a gang membership basis. And the classifications they used at the time was just any association with a known gang member. That's not what this bill does. This is far more specific and would require a finding by a court or a jury that a person was involved in that type of activity. So I think that the mere fact of an intelligence officer classifying someone as a gang member and putting that out in a computerized format, which was the problem in the past, as opposed to a court judgment here, those are worlds apart. Again, I think we have to be sensitive of that type of situation, and I think Chief Foxworth is sensitive about that. But again, I think that this bill does not do that, and it would require a finding by a court about this type of activity before a person would be classified in that nature. So we're talking about far different situations than what existed in the early 1990s, and I would concede probably was not very well applied by the Portland Police Bureau at the time.
So this is more a predicate for sentencing.
Yes, that's what this is, and requires a court finding, as opposed to some police officer who happens to be assembling a file on someone making that determination by himself in his office.
And would this, I'll ask one more. Would this make a difference in a case? There was a case recently in Portland where it was a gang-involved shooting, and they weren't, the judge wasn't allowing that evidence in, apparently. And at one point, some gangsters came in, in my belief, to intimidate a witness on the stand who was testifying. And when the deputy district attorney wanted to get that evidence out before the jury and ask the witness, do you know who those people are, the judge wouldn't allow that because he thought that would prejudice the jury. Would this law lead to more, where that kind of evidence could be admitted?
Well, Chair Barker, I believe that that was a common problem in the early 1990s. Now, I can't speak to that particular case, but I know that I tried a number of cases where rival gang members would come sit in the back of the courtroom, where they would sit outside the the courtroom. I tried a murder case where a witness disappeared in the middle of testimony. In the course of her testimony, a key witness, because she was intimidated and threatened by gang members. Judges have been all across the board in our county of allowing testimony about gang membership or not allowing that testimony about gang membership. This, I believe, would give a directive to the court that type of testimony about the motive of a crime or the membership of an individual who's being prosecuted would be admissible evidence. So I think it would, I'm not saying it would be a perfect solution, because there probably would be some judges who would still not be inclined to either only allow it in a sentencing proceeding or somehow limit that testimony, but it certainly would, I think, give a clearer directive to the courts.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative McPherson.
Yeah, for Mr. French, I see that the original printed bill provides for, just generally for, the court may impose a sentence that is longer than the presumptive sentence, but then the -1 amendments are much more specific, They would provide that the Criminal Justice Commission shall classify the aggravated crime two levels higher than the unaggravated crime on the crime seriousness scale. I'm wondering if you could, if you have any background on how that change, proposed change in the through the Dash 1 amendments came about.
Well, assuming that we work on the Dash 1 amendments here, I think that gives you a very specific idea of what the enhancement would be. It essentially, the Oregon State Sentencing Guideline grid blocks classify all crimes by, all criminal activity by a matrix system which takes into account the criminal background of an individual as far as convictions are concerned, and also the crime seriousness level of the crime. Now, if a crime seriousness level were, say, level 6, typical of level 6, I believe, would be some drug dealing, some assaults, and that would, the range of sentence could be anywhere from a probationary sentence if a person has no prior criminal history to, if a person has three prior felony convictions, could be as much as, this is off the top of my head, but I'm going to say about 40 to 50 months at the worst, for the worst offender in prison. By changing the scale there from a 6 to then it would be an 8, you might go anywhere from adding a few months to the person's sentence to virtually doubling that person's sentence if they have a very, very serious criminal record. So I could show you if I had a grid block with me. I don't, but it essentially it would... It would. Oh, that's
actually
that's what we
have
right
Thatcher.
If I could just interrupt momentarily and answer one portion of your question more specifically, Representative McPherson, it was brought to my attention by a couple of different people, including Mr. Prinz of the Criminal Justice Commission, Ms. Quinn of the courts, that by simply saying in the initial bill may impose a longer sentence, the fiscal was, among other things, going to be absolutely impossible to determine because may impose a longer sentence could be anything. And so it was at Mr. Prinz's suggestion and, again, conversations with a few other people that we do something more specific. Certainly, if there were other suggestions on what to do, I did look at California's statute, for example, says a court shall impose a longer prison sentence of a range from 1 to 3 years, 2 being presumptive, but they could do 1 or 3, depending on findings similar to what a judge would find under the Criminal Justice Commission rules. So there are other ways to approach it. I just went with the 2 steps higher because it seemed a simple way to do that within our sentencing guidelines that we already have in existence.
And Representative McPherson, looking at a grid block here, I'm noting that's been kindly provided to me now, that for the most serious offender, say on a level 6 offense, would go from a range of 25 to 30 months to 41 to 45, which adds approximately, 50%, up to 50% to the person's potential sentence there. He could go from a probationary sentence if the person has a minor criminal record and would normally have a probationary sentence. He could be sentenced to prison for anywhere between 16 and 24 months, depending upon the grid block. So it is an enhancement. It's not an open-ended enhancement. It is one which I think is reasonable, and given the light and the nature of gang activity and the effects on the community, I think that an enhancement of that nature is actually quite reasonable.
Paul, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Please.
In eyeballing the grid, it looks to me as though toward the lower end, it tends to add about half again to doubling the amount of time. And as you get up into the more serious offenses, it's the 2 steps is more like doubling or tripling. I mean, if you look at, as you get toward the upper left corner where you've got the more serious offenses and longer criminal history, if you take out seriousness level 9, if it were enhanced to an 11, you're tripling or more of that. And so I would just throw out a question about, I understand the need to try to be maybe a little bit more precise than the way the original printed bill works, but I'm not sure that the directive to have a two-step increase is maybe, particularly as it gets applied to certain parts of the grid, whether that's really appropriate. I mean, if you look at if it were a very serious crime, if we were taking somebody up from, 56 months to 178 months, that's just because they were part of a gang. I realize it's a problem that they're part of a gang, but I think it's more of a problem maybe at the less serious offenses.
Representative McPherson, one of the things to realize here, virtually all of those level 9 and 10 offenses that you're looking at will be also Measure 11 offenses. Right. In many instances, the Measure 11 sentence will be higher anyway.
Yeah.
So, yes, it does in those instances lead to a substantially higher, and I can see the potential there for what could be up to three times the level in Level A. I suppose that's something to be considered, although I guess if a person has three prior violent felony offenses and is involved in a criminal organization, a gang activity, and commits another violent offense because of that, and this is by nature would be another violent offense, to put him at a level 9 or 10, I think a lot of people would consider it reasonable that in California he would have a life sentence under those circumstances. He would have had a life sentence with his third prior conviction.
If I could, Mr. Chair, I guess what strikes me is that at the lower levels of seriousness, yeah, the gang connection may be an appropriate driver to have people have a little firmer kind of response to sort of shape people's conduct. When you're looking at the more serious offenses and the longer criminal history, the fact that it's gang connected probably is a pretty tangential aspect of what's a very serious criminal history, and so then it seems to me the two-level enhancement probably is maybe less appropriate. And although I take your point that generally we're in Measure 11 territory at that point, so maybe it's kind of theoretical rather than actual.
Chair Barker and Representative McPherson, I don't disagree with you about that, really. I mean, I think we have the tools to deal with very violent offenders in this state right now with Measure 11. So this is not a sticking point with me one way or another. I think it's appropriate if a person has an extraordinarily long, violent criminal history and then commits another violent offense as a gang member, that there should be a substantial enhancement. And it doesn't offend me that it's even a tripling. But it's really, I think we have tools elsewhere to deal with that offender. We don't have the tools to deal with right now with the other lower level offenses that you're talking about, too. So that's, I don't know how we could write that. But I think you're accurate in your assessment of the lower levels, and this would be effective for enhancing gang activity, for the type of activities which most affect the community and that we don't have tools for now. You're correct, and I'd hate to see the bill somehow not be approved simply because of that. And so, again, it's not a sticking point. I don't know how the other members of the law enforcement community would think about that. You understand that?
Yeah. No, I would agree. I think Mr. French summed it up perfectly. There's other tools, other ways to deal with it, and certainly would not want this to stop moving this bill forward.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think I'd like to have some conversation with staff maybe about how to try to solve that dimension of it.
Okay. I guess I'll just ask from a prosecutor's standpoint, just for the record, I imagine that prosecuting... I'm asking Mr. French his prosecutor's standpoint. Prosecuting gang crimes can be difficult. You mentioned witness intimidation and things like that. Is it safe to assume that oftentimes there are witnesses who just will not cooperate, period, in these types of cases?
It's not just safe to assume that. That's almost a presumption in gang cases.
And so if you have, for example, about Measure 11 crime that you have charged, my understanding is a lot of the times a person with about Measure 11 crime would be offered perhaps an opportunity to plead to an attempted about Measure 11 crime, and then in that case would maybe that flexibility with the two steps up on the crime seriousness scale help?
Well, again, we're talking about a tool here, and I think, yes, the answer is as far as a defendant, and we must, you know, view this as, in many ways, a calculation on the part of a defendant. Do I want to go to trial and risk going to jail for 269 months if the state is offering me a guilty plea, something less than that? Do I want to do that? I mean, obviously, that raises the ability of the state to offer a bargain that the defendant would accept, if that's what you're getting at there. You know, trials can be traumatic experiences for a lot of instances here because of the things you were discussing, the intimidation of witnesses. I mean, it's a difficult situation to deal with. Especially in gang cases, and as I say, there's almost a presumption in serious gang cases that your witnesses are going to be threatened, that you're going to have to go to great extent to bring witnesses in to testify, and then when they testify, they may retract what they say on the witness stand, depending on who shows up. So it's always a risk. It's always a risk to go to trial, and this would be a tool that would assist prosecutors, I suspect, no matter where the enhancement level is set, to achieve a resolution short of trial.
Mr. Chair, just one thing. I would ask for your committee support on passing the bill with the amendments. We're dealing, and again, I just want to, I'm going to reiterate my earlier testimony, if I could. We have got huge, serious problems with gangs in East Multnomah County, something that doesn't get reported a lot. And whatever we can do in this regard, I think this is a reasonable effort to help law enforcement, especially in our area in East Multnomah County, but certainly around the state where this is a growing problem as well. And we would appreciate your support. And I do also want to just take one moment and thank Bill Taylor, his staff, along with Chief Peluso, for all of the work they've done, not only on this issue, but as well as prior issues on dealing and bringing education on gang enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you, panel. Mr. Hummel, Ms. Meyer. Please.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is John Hummel. I'm a criminal defense attorney in Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. OCDLA is opposed to House Bill 2313 because criminal laws should punish actions, not beliefs, thoughts, or associations. If a non-gang member brutally assaults a woman, is her pain any less because the assault occurred at the hands of a non-gang member as opposed to a gang member? Of course not. Why then should her assailant receive a less severe punishment than a criminal who is a member of a gang and who commits an identical assault against another victim would receive? If the crimes are the same, the punishment should be the same. Reducing penalties for non-gang crimes is not the answer to our gang problem. Some specific concerns that OCDLA has. First, I note in the bill and in the amendments, a person is deemed a criminal street gang member, or one of the elements of determining if a person is a criminal street gang member, is if a witness called by the prosecution says the person is a gang member. There is no requirement that the witness be believed by the jury. There's just the mere requirement that a witness called by the prosecution says they are. And the jury could actually disbelieve the witness, find that witness wasn't credible, but the state would be able to argue in closing argument that the law says if a witness says it, that's the case. And I don't imagine that was the intent, but that is how the law is drafted. Another concern is a common style of dress is one of the elements of a criminal street gang. Criminalizing the clothes one wears is a restriction on one's right to express themselves, which runs the risk of violating Article 1 Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, which states, no law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion. A third specific objection is, it is not clear from the bill whether the gang allegations would be proven in the guilt phase of the trial or in the sentencing phase of the trial. If a gang allegation evidence is produced or introduced in the guilt phase of the trial, common sense just dictates that a jury is more likely to convict someone of anything if they think the person is a member of a gang than if they think they're not a member of a gang. So introducing the evidence in the guilt phase would definitely impermissibly prejudice a defendant. And as we're all aware, the Senate right now is working on a bill to fix the Blakely problem. That bill is still a work in progress, but it contemplates dividing acts into offender-specific acts or offense-specific acts. And acts which deal with the character of the defendant would be introduced to a sentencing phase. That wouldn't be introduced in the guilt phase of a jury. So if a person is found guilty in the sentencing phase, then you impanel the jury again. You can introduce evidence that you think they're a gang member. If the jury agrees with that, then you would have the enhanced penalty. So this bill should be viewed in light of the fact that we have another bill coming over to this side, and it should be consistent with that. So that's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I just have one where you said reducing penalties for non-gang crimes is not the answer. I'm assuming you're not asking that we move the rest of the scale up there.
No, Chair Barker, thank you for that. But we would be creating a difference where a victim might say, if she was assaulted by a non-gang member, she might say, why is my assault less worthy than my neighbor who received the exact same beating? Why does my assailant get 20 months in prison and her assailant gets 40 months? Why are they treating me differently? Is my crime less worthy? And that's the concern. Thank you.
Mr. Hummel, while I don't know, I mean, having been the person who changed the informant portions of the statute to a witness called by the prosecution portion of the, you know, I changed that, I'm curious to know what you would suggest. Let's just assume for the sake of argument that that line stays in some form or another. How would you change the language? I mean, to me, the state has to prove that element beyond a reasonable doubt. To me, the state would have to convince the jury that this witness who testified that individual is a gang member was telling the truth, and that witness is going to be subject to cross-examination by a defense attorney like yourself. So what would you do, or how would you change that one line to make it more clear that that witness would be subject to all of the rules of trial?
Sure, Councilor Millett, Chair Barker, thank you. I don't think that language is necessary, that a prosecution witness so testified. What you have the elements that constitute a gang member, and I don't have that in front of me, actually I do, resides in or frequents a particular gang area, has been arrested more than once, etc. But the prosecution would have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. They would do that through the testimony of witnesses, obviously, but I don't think you need to have the point that one of the elements is a witness called by the prosecution said it is. The witness called by the prosecution would be called to testify to the other elements and of course would have to be believed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay. Ms. Meyer.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU. I actually really have nothing more to add than the ACLU concurs with the concerns and objections raised by the OCDLA today and does oppose House Bill 2313. Thank you.
Thank you. That was short.
Yeah. On occasion, I try to do that.
That's good.
Thank you. It's amazing.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and move this to a work session today. Close the public hearing and open the work session.
Mr. Chair, just by way of, I could offer just a comment. I just say I am troubled about this. I realize that the original printed bill is just very vague about what the enhancement is, but the two-level enhancement, I'm not persuaded that the proportionality makes sense. So I have to say I'm not comfortable with moving the Dash 1 amendments into the bill and then moving the bill out today. I mean, it may be the consensus of people that want to move it forward, in which case I would like to work on with some formulation that makes more sense to me, but I'd say I'm not comfortable with this level.
I understand that. Yes.
If I could, Mr. Chair, if we wanted to, I understand Representative McPherson's concerns. If we wanted to move it out of full committee today, I could wait to set this for a work session in the full committee a few weeks. I could work with Representative McPherson. I know Ms. Vanderbilt from Legislative Council pointed out to me a concern she had about, I don't even remember how I phrase it, felony crime of violence, I think was the phrase I used, and she said that's undefined in the revised statutes and suggested person felony as defined by the Criminal Justice Commission rules. So there's already a few little changes that need to be made, but like we have done with other bills, if we want to move this out to full, I can get some Dash 2 amendments done before the full committee meets.
That's what I'd like to do. I'm getting concerned, even though I don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. I'm afraid that light's going to show up one day real quick, and I'd like to get some of these things on the road so I can get them working.
Well, I'll vote for the bill on the understanding that we're going to be working on it further in full.
I have to admit, too, Mr. Chair, there's a couple elements here, too, for identifying the criteria I have a little concern with, too. But, yeah, I like the idea, the concept.
Well, I'll move it. I'll move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2313.
Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2313 as amended to the full committee for further consideration.
Two passed.
Okay.
Okay, and I'll move it. We'll take a roll call for this, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And as we move that, we will expect some work to be done on that, and Representative McPherson will be assisting Council Board with that. And so hopefully we can have something.
Thank you.
Okay. Next.
Mr. Chair, I need 2 minutes before we start. Okay. 390. I apologize. I have a work group starting in 8 minutes. I just want to get someone else working on it.
We're going to temporarily recess for just a few minutes.
reopen the committee hearing, and we'll hear House Bill 2390. And Lieutenant Williams and Kelly Brooks.
And as they come up, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to alert for the committee. There are two sets of amendments here, and they, depending on what the committee wants to do, they probably ought to be both adopted. They don't; one does not supersede the other. House Bill 2390, in its original form, made it a crime for an individual to refuse to identify themselves to a police officer when that person was at a crime scene. Concerns about this bill have been raised, and so working with the sponsors of the bill, I submitted these Dash 1 amendments. What the Dash 1 amendments did was elevated the crime being investigated to a felony, and then made this, instead of making this a crime, refusal to identify, it made it a violation, but provided the opportunity or the tool for the officers to detain the person long enough to identify them, including transportation to a police station for a photograph and fingerprints, and then releasing them immediately upon the fingerprinting and photographing being done. I felt that in the sort of final constitutional analysis that the community interests would better be balanced by elevating that crime to a felony and giving this violation treatment instead of criminal treatment. After that, we heard from the Eugene Police Department, and I'm going to go ahead and let them describe why they have requested the Dash 2 amendments, because the Dash 2 amendments are the result of Eugene Police Department's recent experience.
Thank you, Tim. Or whoever wants to start here.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kelly Brooks. I'm a legislative analyst with the City of Eugene. And as counsel described, we were not involved in the drafting of the underlying bill. However, after reading it, realized that it might address a situation that we've run into dealing with the issuance of citations. And I'm just going to hand it over to Lieutenant Williams to describe that.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, committee members, I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak to you this morning advocating this amendment.
Just need to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, sir. I'm Lieutenant Kel Williams. I'm a sworn officer with the Eugene Police Department. I've been so employed there for 28 years. In a nutshell this morning, the reason we're advocating for this amendment is to plug a longstanding hole in ORS. In a nutshell specifically, ORS requires that a driver operating a motor vehicle, when stopped for violation, to be in possession of a driver's license and to present that driver's license to a peace officer. For some reason, through oversight or whatever, there is no similar provision for identification on the part of a pedestrian or a bicyclist or some other person using public highways and committing a violation of chapters of the ORS. Although there are specific chapters that control behavior of pedestrians and bicyclists. So what we in essence have is an obligation on the part of police officers to regulate that behavior, but no requirement on the part of the violator to identify themselves unless they're operating a motor vehicle and required to have a driver's license. What we're asking here is a general provision in this amendment that creates the same obligation as a motor vehicle operator has to identify themselves to a police officer for the purpose of the issuance of a citation, and gives the officer leverage to detain that person to adequately identify them for the purpose of completing a citation and releasing them if they choose to decline to identify themselves. Now, this isn't an extremely common occurrence, but when it does occur, it takes a lot of time. And by way of example, we had an incident two weeks ago, roughly, where an officer stopped a bicyclist for operating on one of our city streets after dark with no headlight on the bike. That individual refused to identify herself to the police officer, which raised concern that possibly they were wanted or had some other reason for concealing their identity, which required the officer to ask for cover, which tied up another officer, requested a supervisor. So we wound up with two officers and a supervisor. The supervisor spent about 30 minutes talking to police legal counsel to see if there was some other statute, like obstructing government administration or interfering with a police officer, that we could bend to the purpose of holding this person accountable and get him a citation issued. Ultimately, the officer had to let the person go. Fortunately, another officer recognized the individual from a photograph the next day, and we were able to follow that up. But it was very frustrating, and this is a recurrent situation, has been for years, possibly decades, where officers find themselves occasionally faced with that and no tool to deal with it.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This fills in a gap in something that I always wondered about, because I am a cyclist, and I've often wondered if I've never been stopped for any kind of a traffic violation, but I always wondered what would happen if I just didn't own up to who I was. But now I know, at least after this law is passed. I guess it seems like this is a very good idea. I guess the only thing that caught my eye was on the staff measure summary, it identifies the maximum punishment is a maximum of 30 days imprisonment and a $1,250 fine. Those seem pretty steep at the high end for this offense. Is there a way of fitting this in so that it wouldn't have that kind of consequence?
I'll go ahead and take this one. Representative McPherson, that is the bill as it currently exists. However, because we have the -1 amendments, which would reduce this to a violation, it would be fine only.
Gotcha.
I write the staff measure summaries assuming the initial bill and
sorry,
not the amendment.
I wasn't focusing
no
correctly.
Problem.
That resolves the question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Hummel, Ms. Meyer again.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is John Hummel. I'm a criminal defense attorney in Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I've submitted written testimony that's somewhat detailed. I'll be briefer now. House Bill 2390 is a laudable effort to provide peace officers with another tool to use in their investigation of criminal activity. Unfortunately, the tool is not constitutionally permissible. It is a violation of the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution to criminalize refusing to provide one's name to the police, except if the person has been lawfully detained based upon reasonable suspicion that they have committed an offense, and if the request to identify is reasonably related to the circumstances that justified the stop. House Bill 2390, as originally drafted, criminalizes refusing to provide one's name even if there is no suspicion that they have committed a crime and with no requirement that the request be related to the circumstances that justify the stop. There's three relevant scenarios I provided. The first one, 911 dispatch receives a report of an assault that occurred in a particular truck in a particular location. Police officers dispatched, approaches the man who is in the truck. There's a woman there. The man's drunk and belligerent. The officer sees skid marks behind the truck, indicating to him that it came to a pretty abrupt stop. The officer asks the man for his driver's license. The man refuses 11 times. The officer cites the man under a state statute that criminalizes refusing to provide your identity when you've been reasonably stopped. And the case goes up to the United States Supreme Court. They heard it last term. It's Heibel versus Nevada. The court ruled that the arrest in that case was permissible. It was an appropriate arrest because the Nevada statute and the actions of the officer complied with the Fourth Amendment, the requirements of the Fourth Amendment, which are at the time the request for identification was made, the suspect was validly stopped for suspicion of committing a crime, and the request for identification was reasonably related to that stop. The second scenario, two officers are patrolling in a patrol car. They observe two men in an alley. The men look suspicious. The officers drive up to one of the men, asking for his identification, just because he looked a little out of place, though they didn't have any particular basis that he was committing a crime, but they thought he sure might have been up to something. The suspect refuses to provide his identification, and he's arrested under a state statute. That goes up to the United States Supreme Court in 1979, and we get the opinion in Brown versus Texas. The Supreme Court reversed Mr. Brown's conviction because the officer did not have a reasonable basis to believe that Mr. Brown had committed a crime at the time he was asked for his identity. Now, that was an interesting case because the Texas statute at least required a person to be validly stopped for a crime before the request is made. The court reversed in that case because they felt that the officer did not comply with the statute that so required a suspect to be validly stopped for suspicion of a crime. House Bill 2390, on the other hand,
different from Texas and Nevada, does not have the requirement that a person be validly stopped for suspicion of a crime before they are asked for their identity. So if House Bill 2390 is enacted into law, we could have the third scenario that I set forth. An innocent woman is hurriedly walking down the sidewalk with her child in the middle of the day. She's in a rush to get to the local elementary school to pick up her other child who is sick. An officer who is investigating a burglary that occurred the week before in that neighborhood is approaching numerous people on the sidewalk to ask them if they have seen any suspicious people in the neighborhood within the last week. The officer approaches the woman and asks if she has a minute to talk. She tells him no as she hurries on her way. He then asks for her name and phone number so he can follow up with her later. As she continues to walk away, she tells him she would rather not give her name. The officer arrests her for a violation of House Bill 2390. The woman is convicted and appeals the decision to the Court of Appeals. Her conviction is reversed because House Bill 2390 violates the Fourth Amendment because it does not require the woman to be stopped for suspicion of a crime before she is asked to provide her identity. So OCDOA is opposed to House Bill 2390 as drafted. Now, I did certainly was here for the testimony of the Eugene police officer and the legislative analyst from the city of Eugene. OCDOA would not be opposed to such a bill that we heard, because such a bill, as conceptually as I've heard, says if an officer intends to cite someone for violation of an offense, then they can require the name. That makes common sense, and it's also constitutionally permissible, because under the Fourth Amendment, if someone is validly stopped for reasonable suspicion of a crime, they can be asked for their identity. And it would pass constitutional muster under the Fourth Amendment, and it's also common sense. If you intend to charge someone with an offense, the only way you can do that is to know their name. So that's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. Again, I will be brief. The ACLU does oppose this bill, and I want to be clear on one thing that Mr. Hummel said. We agree that a separate bill discussing only, I think it would be then the subsection B in the dash 2s, a separate bill that does not piggyback on this concept would not be a problem, but any piggybacking onto this bill we would not support. As Mr. Hummel said, we believe and agree that this implicates the Fourth Amendment and also arguably potentially the Fifth Amendment. Officers, as I'm speaking to two in front of me right now, know that they can stop and engage and discuss with people as long as the person wants to keep talking to them, be they a witness or anyone else. If they're not suspected of criminal activity, or even if they are, it's when they detain them that you need the triggering of a suspicion of that they are engaged in criminal activity to detain them. They can talk to them beforehand. If the person says, I don't want to talk to you, I don't even want to give my name, you know, that's in part a Fifth Amendment right that they have not to give information. So you certainly have the Fourth Amendment threshold that I don't think you get over on this, and then I believe that if that upon passage of that threshold, you would still have arguably the Fifth Amendment. So for all these reasons, we urge you not to move forward on this proposal because of its constitutional imperatives. Thank you.
Any questions? This was originally, the reason this bill came down, I don't know if I've talked to you about that, was the case in Portland where there was a shooting and there's people and nobody would identify themselves. The police wanted to know who was there for a couple of different reasons. And the example, Mr. Hummel, you gave of somebody being stopped after about a burglary that occurred the week or a day or has troubled me on this one. So I'm going to, I think we won't move this one out today. I'm going to ask, I'm still interested in the bill, though, and I'm going to ask Ms. Mowad to try to tighten that kind of language up to get to the concerns on that and see if we can't come within the constitutional concerns that you have, or at least the constitutional concerns the court will have. Well, Mr.
Barton, we'd like to think they're the same.
They may be. That's what we're going to try to figure out. But thank you very much for your testimony on that. And with that, I'll close the hearing on House Bill 2390. Is there any further business to come before the committee today? Adjourned.